but he was determined to make her confess an affection for him. He thought he saw in her drooping eye, her unstable glance, her wavering manner, the symptoms of a budding passion. He wanted to stand near her and make her lay her hand in his. He wanted to find out what her next step would be, what the next sign of feeling for him would be. Such anxiety and enthusiasm had not affected him for years. He was a youth again in feeling, a cavalier in action. In his position, opportunity for taking his evenings out was excellent. He was a most faithful worker in general, and a man who commanded the confidence of his employers insofar as the distribution of his time was concerned. He could take such hours off as he chose, for it was well known that he fulfilled his managerial duties successfully, whatever time he might take. His grace, tact, and ornate appearance gave the place an air which was most essential, while at the same time his long experience made him a most excellent judge of its stock necessities. Bartenders and assistants might come and go, singly or in groups, but so long as he was present, the host of old-time customers would barely notice the change. He gave the place the atmosphere to which they were used. Consequently, he arranged his hours very much to suit himself, taking now an afternoon, now an evening, but invariably returning between 11 and 12 to witness the last hour or two of the day's business and look after the closing details. "You see that things are safe and all the employees are out when you go home, George," Moy had once remarked to him, and he never once, in all the period of his long service, neglected to do this. Neither of the owners had for years been in the resort after 5 in the afternoon, and yet their manager as faithfully fulfilled this request as if they had been there regularly to observe. On this Friday afternoon, scarcely 2 days after his previous visit, he made up his mind to see Carrie. He could not stay away longer. "Evans," he said, addressing the head barkeeper, "if anyone calls, I will be back between 4 and 5. He hurried to Madison Street and boarded a horse car, which carried him to Ogden Place in 30 minutes. Carrie had thought of going for a walk and had put on a light gray woolen dress with a jaunty double-breasted jacket. She had out her hat and gloves and was fastening a white lace tie about her throat when the housemaid brought up the information that Mr. Hurst would wish to see her. She started slightly at the announcement, but told the girl to say that she would come down in a moment, and proceeded to hasten her dressing. Carrie could not have told herself at this moment whether she was glad or sorry that the impressive manager was awaiting her presence. She was slightly flurried and tingling in the cheeks, but it was more nervousness than either fear or favor. She did not try to conjecture what the drift of the conversation would be. She only felt that she must be careful and that Hurstwood had an indefinable fascination for her. Then she gave her tie its last touch with her fingers and went below. The deep-feeling manager was himself a little strained in the nerves by the thorough consciousness of his mission. He felt that he must make a strong play on this occasion, but now that the hour was come and he heard Carrie's feet upon the stair, his nerve failed him. He sank a little in determination, for he was not so sure, after all, what her opinion might be. When she entered the room, however, her appearance gave him courage. She looked simple and charming enough to strengthen the daring of any lover. Her apparent nervousness dispelled his own. "How are you?" he said easily. "I could not resist the temptation to come out this afternoon. It was so pleasant." "Yes," said Carrie, halting before him. "I was just preparing to go for a walk myself."
"Oh, you were," he said. "Supposing, then, you get your hat and we both go."
They crossed the park and went west along Washington Boulevard, beautiful with its broad macadamized road and large frame houses set back from the sidewalks. It was a street where many of the more prosperous residents of the West Side lived, and Hurstwood could not help feeling nervous over the publicity of it. They had gone but a few blocks when a livery stable sign in one of the side streets solved the difficulty for him. He would take her to drive along the new boulevard. The boulevard at that time was little more than a country road. The part he intended showing her was much farther out on this same west side, where there was scarcely a house. It connected Douglas Park with Washington or South Park, and was nothing more than a neatly made road, running due south for some 5 miles over an open, grassy prairie, and then due east over the same kind of prairie for the same distance. There was not a house to be encountered anywhere along the larger part of the route, and any conversation would be pleasantly free of interruption. At the stable he picked a gentle horse, and they were soon out of range of either public observation or hearing. "Can you drive?" he said after a time. "I never tried," said Carrie. He put the reins in her hand and folded his arms. "You see, there's nothing to it much," he said smilingly. "Not when you have a gentle horse," said Carrie. "You can handle a horse as well as anyone after a little practice," he added encouragingly. He had been looking for some time for a break in the conversation when he could give it a serious turn. Once or twice he had held his peace, hoping that in silence her thoughts would take the color of his own, but she had lightly continued the subject. Presently, however, his silence controlled the situation. The drift of his thoughts began to tell. He gazed fixedly at nothing in particular, as if he were thinking of something which concerned her not at all. His thoughts, however, spoke for themselves. She was very much aware that a climax was pending.
"Do you know," he said, "I have spent the happiest evenings in years since I have known you?"
"Have you?"
she said, with assumed airiness, but still excited by the conviction which the tone in his voice carried. "I was going to tell you the other evening," he added, "but somehow the opportunity slipped away."
Carrie was listening without attempting to reply. She could think of nothing worthwhile to say. Despite all the ideas concerning Wright which had troubled her vaguely since she had last seen him, she was now influenced again strongly in his favor. "I came out here today," he went on solemnly, "to tell you just how I feel, to see if you wouldn't listen to me." Hurstwood was something of a romanticist after his kind. He was capable of strong feelings, often poetic ones, and under a stress of desire, such as the present, he waxed eloquent. That is, his feelings and his voice were colored with that seeming repression and pathos which is the essence of eloquence.
"You know," he said, putting his hand on her arm, and keeping a strange silence while he formulated words, "that I love you."
Carrie did not stir at the words. She was bound up completely in the man's atmosphere. He would have church-like silence in order to express his feelings, and she kept it. She did not move her eyes from the flat, open scene before her. Hurstwood waited for a few moments, and then repeated the words.
"You must not say that," she said weakly.
Her words were not convincing at all. They were the result of a feeble thought that something ought to be said. He paid no attention to them whatever.
"Carrie," he said, using her first name with sympathetic familiarity, "I want you to love me. You don't know how much I need someone to waste a little affection on me. I am practically alone. There is nothing in my life that is pleasant or delightful. It's all work and worry with people who are nothing to me."
As he said this, Hurstwood really imagined that his state was pitiful. He had the ability to get off at a distance and view himself objectively, of seeing what he wanted to see in the things which made up his existence. Now, as he spoke, his voice trembled with that peculiar vibration which is the result of tensity. It went ringing home to his companion's heart.
"Why, I should think," she said, turning upon him large eyes which were full of sympathy and feeling, "that you would be very happy. You know so much of the world."
"That is it," he said, his voice dropping to a soft minor. "I know too much of the world." It was an important thing to her to hear one so well-positioned and powerful speaking in this manner. She could not help feeling the strangeness of her situation. How was it that in so little a while the narrow life of the country had fallen from her as a garment, and the city with all its mystery taken its place? Here was this greatest mystery, the man of money and affairs sitting beside her, appealing to her. Behold, he had ease and comfort. His strength was great, his position high, his clothing rich, and yet he was appealing to her. She could formulate no thought which would be just and right. She troubled herself no more upon the matter. She only basked in the warmth of his feeling, which was as a grateful blaze to one who was cold. Hurst would glowed with his own intensity, and the heat of his passion was already melting the wax of his companion's scruples. "You think," he said, "I am happy, that I ought not to complain? If you were to meet all day with people who care absolutely nothing about you, if you went day after day to a place where there was nothing but show and indifference, if there was not one person in all those you knew to whom you could appeal for sympathy or talk to with pleasure, perhaps you would be unhappy, too." He was striking a chord now which found sympathetic response in her own situation. She knew what it was to meet with people who were indifferent, to walk alone amid so many who cared absolutely nothing about you. Had not she? Was not she, at this very moment, quite alone? Who was there among all whom she knew to whom she could appeal for sympathy? Not one. She was left to herself to brood and wonder. "I would be content," went on Hurstwood, "if I had you to love me. If I had you to go to, you for a companion. As it is, I simply move about from place to place without any satisfaction. Time hangs heavily on my hands. Before you came, I did nothing but idle and drift into anything that offered itself. Since you came, well, I've had you to think about." The old illusion that here was someone who needed her aid began to grow in Carrie's mind. She truly pitied this sad, lonely figure. To think that all his fine state should be so barren for want of her, that he needed to make such an appeal when she herself was lonely and without anchor. Surely this was too bad. "I'm not very bad," he said apologetically, as if he owed it to her to explain on this score. "You think, probably, that I roam around and get into all sorts of evil? I have been rather reckless, but I could easily come out of that. I need you to draw me back, if my life ever amounts to anything." Carrie looked at him with the tenderness which virtue ever feels in its hope of reclaiming vice. How could such a man need reclaiming? His errors, what were they that she could correct? Small they must be, where all was so fine. At worst, they were gilded affairs, and with what leniency are gilded heirs viewed. He put himself in such a lonely light that she was deeply moved. "Is it that way?" she mused. He slipped his arm about her waist, and she could not find the heart to draw away. With his free hand, he seized upon her fingers. A breath of soft spring wind went bounding over the road, rolling some brown twigs of the previous autumn before it. The horse paced leisurely on, unguided. "Tell me," he said softly, "that you love me." Her eyes fell consciously. "Own to it, dear," he said feelingly. "You do, don't you?" She made no answer, but he felt his victory. "Tell me," he said richly, drawing her so close that their lips were near together. He pressed her hand warmly and then released it to touch her cheek. "You do," he said, pressing his lips to her own. For answer, her lips replied. "Now," he said joyously, his fine eyes ablaze, "you're my own girl, aren't you?" By way of further conclusion, her head lay softly upon his shoulder. 14. With eyes and not seeing, one influence wanes. Carrie in her rooms that evening was in a fine glow, physically and mentally. She was deeply rejoicing in her affection for Hurstwood and his love, and looked forward with fine fancy to their next meeting Sunday night. They had agreed, without any feeling of enforced secrecy, that she should come downtown and meet him, though, after all, the need of it was the cause. Mrs. Hale, from her upper window, saw her come in. She thought to herself. She goes riding with another man when her husband is out of the city. He had better keep an eye on her. The truth is that Mrs. Hale was not the only one who had a thought on this score. The housemaid who had welcomed Hurstwood had her opinion also. She had no particular regard for Carrie, whom she took to be cold and disagreeable. At the same time, she had a fancy for the merry and easy-mannered Drouet, who threw her a pleasant remark now and then, and in other ways extended her the evidence of that regard which he had for all members of the sex. Hurstwood was more reserved and critical in his manner. He did not appeal to this modest functionary in the same pleasant way. She wondered that he came so frequently, that Mrs. Drouet should go out with him this afternoon when Mr. Drouet was absent. She gave vent to her opinions in the kitchen where the cook was. As a result, a hum of gossip was set going which moved about the house in that secret manner common to gossip. Carrie, now that she had yielded sufficiently to Hurstwood to confess her affection, no longer troubled about her attitude toward him. Temporarily she gave little thought to Drouet, thinking only of the dignity and grace of her lover and of his consuming affection for her. On the first evening she did little but go over the details of the afternoon. It was the first time her sympathies had ever been thoroughly aroused, and they threw a new light on her character. She had some power of initiative, latent before, which now began to exert itself. She looked more practically upon her state, and began to see glimmerings of a way out. Hurstwood seemed a drag in the direction of honor. Her feelings were exceedingly creditable, in that they constructed out of these recent developments something which conquered freedom from dishonor. She had no idea what Hurstwood's next word would be. She only took his affection to be a fine thing, and appended better, more generous results accordingly. As yet, Hurstwood had only thought of pleasure without responsibility. He did not feel that he was doing anything to complicate his life. His position was secure. His home life, if not satisfactory, was at least undisturbed. His personal liberty rather untrammeled. Carrie's love represented only so much added pleasure. He would enjoy this new gift over and above his ordinary allowance of pleasure. He would be happy with her, and his own affairs would go on as they had, undisturbed. On Sunday evening, Carrie dined with him at a place he had selected in East Adams Street, and thereafter they took a cab to what was then a pleasant evening resort out on Cottage Grove Avenue, near 39th Street. In the process of his declaration, he soon realized that Carrie took his love upon a higher basis than he had anticipated. She kept him at a distance, in a rather earnest way, and submitted only to those tender tokens of affection which better become the inexperienced lover. Hurstwood saw that she was not to be possessed for the asking, and deferred pressing his suit too warmly. Since he feigned to believe in her married state, he found that he had to carry out the part. His triumph, he saw, was still at a little distance. How far, he could not guess. They were returning to Ogden Place in the cab when he asked, "When will I see you again?" "I don't know," she answered, wondering herself. "Why not come down to the fair," he suggested, "next Tuesday?" She shook her head. "Not so soon," she answered. "I'll tell you what I'll do," he added. "I'll write you care of this West Side post office. Could you call next Tuesday?" Carrie assented. The cab stopped one door out of the way, according to his call. "Good night," he whispered, as the cab rolled away. Unfortunately for the smooth progression of this affair, Drouet returned. Hurstwood was sitting in his imposing little office the next afternoon when he saw Drouet enter. "Why, hello, Charles," he called affably. "Back again?" "Yes," smiled Drouet, approaching and looking in at the door. Hurstwood arose. "Well," he said, looking the drummer over, "rosy as ever, eh?" They began talking of the people they knew and things that had happened. "Been home yet?" finally asked Hurstwood. "No, I am going, though," said Drouet. "I remembered the little girl out there," said Hurstwood, "and called once. Thought you wouldn't want her left quite alone." "Right you are," agreed Drouet. "How is she?" "Very well," said Hurstwood. "Rather anxious about you, though. You'd better go out now and cheer her up." "I will," said Drouet smilingly.
"Like to have you both come down and go to the show with me Wednesday," concluded Hurstwood at parting. "Thanks, old man," said his friend. "I'll see what the girl says and let you know." They separated in the most cordial manner. "There's a nice fellow," Drouet thought to himself as he turned the corner toward Madison. "Drouet's a good fellow," Hurstwood thought to himself as he went back into his office. "But he's no man for Carrie." The thought of the latter turned his mind into a most pleasant vein, and he wondered how he would get ahead of the drummer. When Drouet entered Carrie's presence, he caught her in his arms as usual, but she responded to his kiss with a tremor of opposition. "Well," he said, "I had a great trip."
"Did you? How did you come out with that lacrosse man you were telling me about?"
"Oh, fine. Sold him a complete line. There was another fellow there, representing Bernstein, a regular hook-nosed sheeny, but he wasn't in it. I made him look like nothing at all."
As he undid his collar and unfastened his studs, preparatory to washing his face and changing his clothes, he dilated upon his trip. Carrie could not help listening with amusement to his animated descriptions.
"I tell you," he said, "I surprised the people at the office. I've sold more goods this last quarter than any other man of our house on the road. I sold $3,000 worth in lacrosse."
He plunged his face in a basin of water and puffed and blew as he rubbed his neck and shoulders with his hands, while Carrie gazed upon him with mingled thoughts of recollection and present judgment. He was still wiping his face when he continued,
"I'm going to strike for a raise in June. They can afford to pay it as much business as I turn in. I'll get it, too, don't you forget."
"I hope you do," said Carrie.
"And then, if that little real estate deal I've got on goes through, we'll get married," he said, with a great show of earnestness, the while he took his place before the mirror and began brushing his hair.
"I don't believe you ever intend to marry me, Charlie," Carrie said ruefully. The recent protestations of Hurstwood had given her courage to say this.
"Oh, yes, I do. Of course I do. What put that into your head?"
He had stopped his trifling before the mirror now and crossed over to her. For the first time, Carrie felt as if she must move away from him. "But you've been saying that so long," she said, looking with her pretty face upturned into his.
"Well, and I mean it, too, but it takes money to live as I want to. Now, when I get this increase, I can come pretty near fixing things all right, and I'll do it. Now don't you worry, girlie."
He patted her reassuringly upon the shoulder, but Carrie felt how really futile had been her hopes. She could clearly see that this easygoing soul intended no move in her behalf. He was simply letting things drift because he preferred the free round of his present stay to any legal tramlings. In contrast, Hurstwood appeared strong and sincere. He had no easy manner of putting her off. He sympathized with her and showed her what her true value was. He needed her, while Drouet did not care.
"Oh, no," she said remorsefully, her tone reflecting some of her own success and more of her helplessness.
"You never will."
"Well, you wait a little while and see," he concluded. "I'll marry you all right."
Carrie looked at him and felt justified. She was looking for something which would calm her conscience, and here it was, a light, airy disregard of her claims upon his justice. He had faithfully promised to marry her, and this was the way he fulfilled his promise.
"Say," he said, after he had, as he thought, pleasantly disposed of the marriage question, "I saw Hurstwood today, and he wants us to go to the theater with him."
Carrie started at the name, but recovered quickly enough to avoid notice.
"When?" she asked, with assumed indifference. "Wednesday. We'll go, won't we?"
"If you think so," she answered, her manner being so enforcedly reserved as to almost excite suspicion. Drouet noticed something, but he thought it was due to her feelings concerning their talk about marriage.
"He called once," he said.
"Yes," said Carrie. "He was out here Sunday evening."
"Was he?" said Drouet. "I thought from what he said that he had called a week or so ago."
"So he did," answered Carrie, who was wholly unaware of what conversations her lovers might have held. She was all at sea mentally and fearful of some entanglement which might ensue from what she would answer.
"Oh, then he called twice?" said Drouet,
the first shade of misunderstanding showing in his face.
"Yes,"
said Carrie innocently, feeling now that Hurstwood must have mentioned but one call. Jouet imagined that he must have misunderstood his friend. He did not attach particular importance to the information, after all. "What did he have to say?" he queried, with slightly increased curiosity. "He said he came because he thought I might be lonely. You hadn't been in there so long, he wondered what had become of you." "George is a fine fellow," said Drouet, rather gratified by his conception of the manager's interest. "Come on, and we'll go out to dinner." When Hurstwood saw that Drouet was back, he wrote at once to Carrie, saying, "I told him I called on you, dearest, when he was away. I did not say how often, but he probably thought once. Let me know of anything you may have said. Answer by special messenger when you get this, and, darling, I must see you. Let me know if you can't meet me at Jackson and Throop Streets Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. I want to speak with you before we meet at the theater." Carrie received this Tuesday morning when she called at the West Side branch of the post office and answered at once. "I said you called twice," she wrote. "He didn't seem to mind. I will try and be at Throop Street if nothing interferes. I seem to be getting very bad. It's wrong to act as I do, I know." Hurstwood, when he met her as agreed, reassured her on this score. "You mustn't worry, sweetheart," he said. "Just as soon as he goes on the road again, we'll arrange something. We'll fix it so that you won't have to deceive anyone." Carrie imagined that he would marry her at once, though he had not directly said so, and her spirits rose. She proposed to make the best of the situation until Drouet left again. "Don't show any more interest in me than you ever have," Hurstwood counseled concerning the evening at the theater. "You mustn't look at me steadily, then," she answered, mindful of the power of his eyes. "I won't," he said, squeezing her hand at parting and giving the glance she had just cautioned against. "There," she said playfully, pointing a finger at him. "The show hasn't begun yet," he returned. He watched her walk from him with tender solicitation. Such youth and prettiness reacted upon him more subtly than wine. At the theater, things passed as they had in Hurstwood's favor. If he had been pleasing to Carrie before, how much more so was he now? His grace was more permeating because it found a readier medium. Carrie watched his every movement with pleasure. She almost forgot poor Drouet, who babbled on as if he were the host. Hurstwood was too clever to give the slightest indication of a change. He paid, if anything, more attention to his old friend than usual, and yet in no way held him up to that subtle ridicule which a lover in favor may so secretly practice before the mistress of his heart. If anything, he felt the injustice of the game as it stood, and was not cheap enough to add to it the slightest mental taunt. Only the play produced an ironical situation, and this was due to Drouet alone. The scene was one in The Covenant, in which the wife listened to the seductive voice of a lover in the absence of her husband. "Served him right," said Drouet afterward, even in view of her keen expiation of her error. "I haven't any pity for a man who would be such a chump as that." "Well, you never can tell," returned Hurstwood gently. "He probably thought he was right." "Well, a man ought to be more attentive than that to his wife if he wants to keep her." They had come out of the lobby and made their way through the showy crush about the entranceway.
"Say, mister," said a voice at Hurstwood's side, "would you mind giving me the price of a bed?"
Hurstwood was interestedly remarking to Carrie.
"Honest to God, mister, I'm without a place to sleep."
The plea was that of a gaunt-faced man of about 30 who looked the picture of privation and wretchedness. Drouet was the first to see. He handed over a dime with an upwelling feeling of pity in his heart. Hurstwood scarcely noticed the incident. Carrie quickly forgot. 15. The Irk of the Old Ties. The Magic of Youth. The complete ignoring by Hurstwood of his own home came with the growth of his affection for Carrie. His actions, in all that related to his family, were of the most perfunctory kind. He sat at breakfast with his wife and children, absorbed in his own fancies, which reached far without the realm of their interests. He read his paper, which was heightened in interest by the shallowness of the themes discussed by his son and daughter. Between himself and his wife ran a river of indifference. Now that Carrie had come, he was in a fair way to be blissful again. There was delight in going downtown evenings. When he walked forth in the short days, the street lamps had a merry twinkle. He began to experience the almost forgotten feeling which hastens the lover's feet. When he looked at his fine clothes, he saw them with her eyes, and her eyes were young. When in the flush of such feelings he heard his wife's voice, when the insistent demands of matrimony recalled him from dreams to a stale practice, how it grated! He then knew that this was a chain which bound his feet. "George," said Mrs. Hurstwood, in that tone of voice which had long since come to be associated in his mind with demands, "we want you to get us a season ticket to the races." "Do you want to go to all of them?" he said with a rising inflection. "Yes," she answered. The races in question were soon to open at Washington Park on the south side, and were considered quite society affairs among those who did not affect religious rectitude and conservatism. Mrs. Hurstwood had never asked for a whole season ticket before, but this year certain considerations decided her to get a box. For one thing, one of her neighbors, a certain Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey, who were possessors of money made out of the coal business, had done so. In the next place, her favorite physician, Dr. Beale, a gentleman inclined to horses and betting, had talked with her concerning his intention to enter a 2-year-old in the Derby. In the third place, she wished to exhibit Jessica, who was gaining in maturity and beauty, and whom she hoped to marry to a man of means. Her own desire to be about in such things and parade among her acquaintances and the common throng was as much an incentive as anything. Hurstwood thought over the proposition a few moments without answering. They were in the sitting room on the second floor, waiting for supper. It was the evening of his engagement with Carrie and Drouet to see the Covenant, which had brought him home to make some alterations in his dress. "You're sure separate tickets wouldn't do as well?" he asked, hesitating to say anything more rugged. "No," she replied impatiently. "Well," he said, taking offense at her manner, "you needn't get mad about it. I'm just asking you." "I'm not mad," she snapped. "I'm merely asking you for a season ticket." "And I'm telling you," he returned, fixing a clear, steady eye on her, "that it's no easy thing to get. I'm not sure whether the manager will give it to me." He had been thinking all the time of his pull with the racetrack magnates. "We can buy it then," she exclaimed sharply. "You talk easy," he said. "A season family ticket costs $150. "I'll not argue with you," she replied with determination. "I want the ticket, and that's all there is to it." She had risen and now walked angrily out of the room. "Well, you get it then," he said grimly, though in a modified tone of voice. As usual, the table was one short that evening. The next morning he had cooled down considerably, and later the ticket was duly secured, though it did not heal matters. He did not mind giving his family a fair share of all that he earned, but he did not like to be forced to provide against his will. "Do you know, Mother," said Jessica another day, "the Spencers are getting ready to go away?" "No. Where, I wonder?" "Europe," said Jessica. "I met Georgine yesterday, and she told me. She just put on more airs about it." "Did she say when?" "Monday, I think. They'll get a notice in the papers again. They always do." "Never mind," said Mrs. Hurstwood consolingly. "We'll go one of these days." Hurstwood moved his eyes over the paper slowly, but said nothing. "We sail for Liverpool from New York," Jessica exclaimed, mocking her acquaintance. "Expect to spend most of the summer in France. Vain thing. As if it was anything to go to Europe."
"It must be if you envy her so much," put in Hurstwood.
It grated upon him to see the feeling his daughter displayed.
"Don't worry over them, my dear," said Mrs. Hurstwood. "Did George get off?" asked Jessica of her mother another day, thus revealing something that Hurstwood had heard nothing about.
"Where has he gone?" he asked, looking up. He had never before been kept in ignorance concerning departures.
"'He was going to Wheaton,' said Jessica, not noticing the slight put upon her father. "'What's out there?' he asked, secretly irritated and chagrined, to think that he should be made to pump for information in this manner.
"'A tennis match,' said Jessica.
"'He didn't say anything to me,' Hurstwood concluded, finding it difficult to refrain from a bitter tone.
"'I guess he must have forgotten,' exclaimed his wife blandly.
In the past he had always commanded a certain amount of respect, which was a compound of appreciation and awe. The familiarity which in part still existed between himself and his daughter he had courted. As it was, it did not go beyond the light assumption of words. The tone was always modest. Whatever it had been, however, had lacked affection, and now he saw that he was losing track of their doings. His knowledge was no longer intimate. He sometimes saw them at table, and sometimes did not. He heard of their doings occasionally, more often did not. Some days he found that he was all at sea as to what they were talking about, things they had arranged to do or that they had done in his absence. More affecting was the feeling that there were little things going on of which he no longer heard. Jessica was beginning to feel that her affairs were her own. George Jr. flourished about as if he were a man entirely and must needs have private matters. All this Hurstwood could see, and it left a trace of feeling, for he was used to being considered, in his official position at least, and felt that his importance should not begin to wane here. To darken it all, he saw the same indifference and independence growing in his wife, while he looked on and paid the bills. He consoled himself with the thought, however, that after all he was not without affection. Things might go as they would at his house, but he had Carrie outside of it. With his mind's eye he looked into her comfortable room in Ogden Place, where he had spent several such delightful evenings, and thought how charming it would be when Drouet was disposed of entirely, and she was waiting evenings in cozy little quarters for him. That no cause would come up whereby Drouet would be led to inform Carrie concerning his married state, he felt hopeful. Things were going so smoothly that he believed they would not change. Shortly now he would persuade Carrie, and all would be satisfactory. The day after their theater visit he began writing her regularly, a letter every morning, and begging her to do as much for him. He was not literary by any means, but experience of the world and his growing affection gave him somewhat of a style. This he exercised at his office desk with perfect deliberation. He purchased a box of delicately colored and scented writing paper in monogram, which he kept locked in one of the drawers. His friends now wondered at the cleric and very official-looking nature of his position. The five bartenders viewed with respect the duties which could call a man to do so much desk work and penmanship. Hurstwood surprised himself with his fluency. By the natural law which governs all effort, what he wrote reacted upon him. He began to feel those subtleties which he could find words to express. With every expression came increased conception. Those inmost breathings which there found words took hold upon him. He thought Carrie worthy of all the affection he could there express. Carrie was indeed worth loving if ever youth and grace are to command that token of acknowledgment from life in their bloom. Experience had not yet taken away that freshness of the spirit which is the charm of the body. Her soft eyes contained in their liquid luster no suggestion of the knowledge of disappointment. She had been troubled in a way by doubt and longing, but these had made no deeper impression than could be traced in a certain open wistfulness of glance and speech. The mouth had the expression at times, in talking and in repose, of one who might be upon the verge of tears. It was not that grief was thus ever present. The pronunciation of certain syllables gave to her lips this peculiarity of formation, a formation as suggestive and moving as pathos itself. There was nothing bold in her manner. Life had not taught her domination, superciliousness of grace, which is the lordly power of some women. Her longing for consideration was not sufficiently powerful to move her to demand it. Even now she lacked self-assurance, but there was that in what she had already experienced which left her a little less than timid. She wanted pleasure, she wanted position, and yet she was confused as to what these things might be. Every hour the kaleidoscope of human affairs threw a new luster upon something, and therewith it became for her the desired, the all. Another shift of the box, and some other had become the beautiful, the perfect. On her spiritual side also she was rich in feeling, as such a nature well might be. Sorrow in her was aroused by many a spectacle, an uncritical upwelling of grief for the weak and the helpless. She was constantly pained by the sight of the white-faced, ragged men who slopped desperately by her in a sort of wretched mental stupor. The poorly clad girls who went blowing by her window evenings, hurrying home from some of the shops of the West Side, she pitied from the depths of her heart. She would stand and bite her lips as they passed, shaking her little head and wondering. They had so little, she thought. It was so sad to be ragged and poor. The hang of faded clothes pained her eyes. "And they have to work so hard," was her only comment. On the street sometimes she would see men working, Irishmen with picks, coal heavers with great loads to shovel, Americans busy about some work which was a mere matter of strength, and they touched her fancy. Toil, now that she was free of it, seemed even a more desolate thing than when she was part of it. She saw it through a mist of fancy, a pale, somber half-light, which was the essence of poetic feeling. Her old father, in his flower-dusted miller suit, sometimes returned to her in memory, revived by a face in a window. A shoemaker pegging at his last, a blastman seen through a narrow window in some basement where iron was being melted, a bench-worker seen high aloft in some window, his coat off, his sleeves rolled up. These took her back in fancy to the details of the mill. She felt, though she seldom expressed them, sad thoughts upon this score. Her sympathies were ever with that underworld of toil from which she had so recently sprung and which she best understood. Though Hurstwood did not know it, he was dealing with one whose feelings were as tender and as delicate as this. He did not know, but it was this in her, after all, which attracted him. He never attempted to analyze the nature of his affection. It was sufficient that there was tenderness in her eye, weakness in her manner, good nature and hope in her thoughts. He drew near this lily, which had sucked its waxen beauty and perfume from below a depth of waters which he had never penetrated, and out of ooze and mold which he could not understand. He drew near because it was waxen and fresh. It lightened his feelings for him. It made the morning worthwhile. In a material way, she was considerably improved. Her awkwardness had all but passed, leaving, if anything, a quaint residue which was as pleasing as perfect grace. Her little shoes now fitted her smartly and had high heels. She had learned much about laces and those little neck pieces which add so much to a woman's appearance. Her form had filled out until it was admirably plump and well-rounded. Hurstwood wrote her one morning, asking to meet him in Jefferson Park, Monroe Street. He did not consider it policy to call any more, even when Drouet was at home. The next afternoon he was in the pretty little park by one, and had found a rustic bench beneath the green leaves of a lilac bush which bordered one of the paths. It was at that season of the year when the fullness of spring had not yet worn quite away. At a little pond nearby, some cleanly dressed children were sailing white canvas boats. In the shade of a green pagoda, a buttoned officer of the law was resting, his arms folded, his club at rest in his belt. An old gardener was upon the lawn, with a pair of pruning shears, looking after some bushes. High overhead was the clear blue sky of the new summer, and in the thickness of the shiny green leaves of the trees hopped and twittered the busy sparrows. Hurstwood had come out of his own home that morning feeling much of the same old annoyance. At his store he had idled, there being no need to write. He had come away to this place with a lightness of heart which characterizes those who put weariness behind. Now, in the shade of this cool green bush, he looked about him with the fancy of the lover. He heard the carts go lumbering by upon the neighboring streets, but they were far off and only buzzed upon his ear. The hum of the surrounding city was faint. The clang of an occasional bell was as music. He looked and dreamed a new dream of pleasure which concerned his present fixed condition not at all. He got back in fancy to the old Hurstwood, who was neither married nor fixed in a solid position for life. He remembered the light spirit in which he once looked after the girls, how he had danced, escorted them home, hung over their gates. He almost wished he was back there again. Here in this pleasant scene he felt as if he were wholly free. At 2, Carrie came tripping along the walk toward him, rosy and clean. She had just recently donned a sailor hat for the season with a band of pretty white-dotted blue silk. Her skirt was of a rich blue material, and her shirtwaist matched it, with a thin stripe of blue upon a snow-white ground, stripes that were as fine as hairs. Her brown shoes peeped occasionally from beneath her skirt. She carried her gloves in her hand. Hurstwood looked up at her with delight. "You came, dearest," he said eagerly, standing to meet her and taking her hand. "Of course," she said, smiling. "Did you think I wouldn't?" "I didn't know," he replied. He looked at her forehead, which was moist from her brisk walk. Then he took out one of his own soft, scented silk handkerchiefs and touched her face here and there. "Now," he said affectionately, "you're all right." They were happy in being near one another, in looking into each other's eyes. Finally, when the long flush of delight had subsided, he said, "When is Charlie going away again?" "I don't know," she answered. "He says he has some things to do for the house here now." Hurstwood grew serious, and he lapsed into quiet thought. He looked up after a time to say, "Come away and leave him." He turned his eyes to the boys with the boats, as if the request were of little importance. "Where would we go?" she asked, in much the same manner, rolling her gloves and looking into a neighboring tree. "Where do you want to go?" he inquired. There was something in the tone in which he said this which made her feel as if she must record her feelings against any local habitation. "We can't stay in Chicago," she replied. He had no thought that this was in her mind, that any removal would be suggested. "Why not?" he asked softly. "Oh, because," she said, "I wouldn't want to." He listened to this with but dull perception of what it meant. It had no serious ring to it. The question was not up for immediate decision. "I would have to give up my position," he said. The tone he used made it seem as if the matter deserved only slight consideration. Carrie thought a little, the while enjoying the pretty scene. "I wouldn't like to live in Chicago and him here," she said, thinking of Drouet. "It's a big town, dearest," Hurstwood answered. "It would be as good as moving to another part of the country to move to the South Side." He had fixed upon that region as an objective point. "Anyhow," said Carrie, "I shouldn't want to get married as long as he is here. I wouldn't want to run away." The suggestion of marriage struck Hurstwood forcibly. He saw clearly that this was her idea. He felt that it was not to be gotten over easily. Bigamy lightened the horizon of his shadowy thoughts for a moment. He wondered for the life of him how it would all come out. He could not see that he was making any progress save in her regard. When he looked at her now, he thought her beautiful. What a thing it was to have her love him, even if it be entangling. She increased in value in his eyes because of her objection. She was something to struggle for, and that was everything. How different from the women who yielded willingly. He swept the thought of them from his mind. "And you don't know when he'll go away?" asked Hurstwood quietly. She shook her head. He sighed. "You're a determined little miss, aren't you?" he said after a few moments, looking up into her eyes. She felt a wave of feeling sweep over her at this. It was pride at what seemed his admiration, affection for the man who could feel this concerning her. "No," she said coyly. "But what can I do?" Again he folded his hands and looked away over the lawn into the street.
I wish, he said pathetically, you would come to me. I don't like to be away from you this way.
What good is there in waiting? You're not any happier, are you?
Happier? She exclaimed softly. You know better than that.
Here we are, then, he went on in the same tone, wasting our days. If you are not happy, do you think I am? I sit and write to you the biggest part of the time. I'll tell you what, Carrie, he exclaimed, throwing sudden force of expression into his voice and fixing her with his eyes. I can't live without you, and that's all there is to it.
I'll tell you what, Carrie, he exclaimed, throwing sudden force of expression into his voice and fixing her with his eyes. I can't live without you, and that's all there is to it. Now, he concluded, showing the palm of one of his white hands in a sort of at-an-end, helpless expression, what shall I do?
The shifting of the burden to her appealed to Carrie. The semblance of the load without the weight touched the woman's heart.
Can't you wait a little while yet? She said tenderly. I'll try and find out when he's going.
What good will it do? He asked, holding the same strain of feeling.
Well, perhaps we can arrange to go somewhere.
She really did not see anything clearer than before, but she was getting into that frame of mind where, out of sympathy, a woman yields. Hurstwood did not understand. He was wondering how she was to be persuaded, what appeal would move her to forsake Drouet. He began to wonder how far her affection for him would carry her. He was thinking of some question which would make her tell. Finally, he hit upon one of those problematical propositions which often disguise our own desires while leading us to an understanding of the difficulties which others make for us, and so discover for us a way. It had not the slightest connection with anything intended on his part, and was spoken at random before he had given it a moment's serious thought.
Carrie, he said, looking into her face and assuming a serious look which he did not feel, suppose I were to come to you next week, or this week for that matter, tonight, say, and tell you I had to go away, that I couldn't stay another minute and wasn't coming back any more. Would you come with me?
His sweetheart viewed him with the most affectionate glance, her answer ready before the words were out of his mouth.
Yes, she said.
You wouldn't stop to argue or arrange?
Not if you couldn't wait.
He smiled when he saw that she took him seriously, and he thought what a chance it would afford for a possible junket of a week or two. He had a notion to tell her that he was joking and so brush away her sweet seriousness, but the effect of it was too delightful. He let it stand.
Suppose we don't have time to get married here, he added, as an afterthought striking him.
If we got married as soon as we got to the other end of the journey, it would be all right.
I meant that, he said.
Yes. The morning seemed peculiarly bright to him now. He wondered whatever could have put such a thought into his head. Impossible as it was, he could not help smiling at its cleverness. It showed how she loved him. There was no doubt in his mind now, and he would find a way to win her.
Well, he said jokingly, I'll come and get you one of these evenings. And then he laughed.
I wouldn't stay with you, though, if you didn't marry me, Carrie added reflectively.
I don't want you to, he said tenderly, taking her hand.
She was extremely happy now that she understood. She loved him the more for thinking that he would rescue her so. As for him, the marriage clause did not dwell in his mind. He was thinking that with such affection there could be no bar to his eventual happiness.
Let's stroll about, he said gaily, rising and surveying all the lovely park.
All right, said Carrie. They passed the young Irishman, who looked after them with envious eyes.
"'Tis a fine couple, he observed to himself. They must be rich.
XVI. A witless Aladdin. The Gate to the World. In the course of his present stay in Chicago, Drouet paid some slight attention to the secret order to which he belonged. During his last trip, he had received a new light on its importance.
"I'll tell you," said another drummer to him, "it's a great thing. Look at Hazenstab. He isn't so deuced clever. Of course, he's got a good house behind him, but that won't do alone. I tell you, it's his degree. He's a way-up mason, and that goes a long way. He's got a secret sign that stands for something."
Drouet resolved then and there that he would take more interest in such matters. So when he got back to Chicago, he repaired to his local lodge headquarters.
"I say, Drouet," said Mr. Harry Quinsel, an individual who was very prominent in this local branch of the Elks, "you're the man that can help us out." It was after the business meeting, and things were going socially with a hum. Drouet was bobbing around, chatting and joking with a score of individuals whom he knew.
"What are you up to?" he inquired genially, turning a smiling face upon his secret brother.
"We're trying to get up some theatricals for 2 weeks from today, and we want to know if you don't know some young lady who could take a part. It's an easy part."
"Sure," said Drouet. "What is it?" He did not trouble to remember that he knew no one to whom he could appeal on this score. His innate good nature, however, dictated a favorable reply.
"Well, now, I'll tell you what we are trying to do," went on Mr. Quinsel. "We are trying to get a new set of furniture for the lodge. There isn't enough money in the treasury at the present time, and we thought we would raise it by a little entertainment."
"Sure," interrupted Drouet. "That's a good idea.
Several of the boys around here have got talent. There's Harry Burbeck. He does a fine blackface turn. Mac Lewis is all right at heavy dramatics. Did you ever hear him recite Over the Hills?"
"Never did."
"Well, I'll tell you, he does it fine."
"And you want me to get some woman to take a part?" questioned Drouet, anxious to terminate the subject and get on to something else. "What are you going to play?"
"Under the Gaslight," said Mr. Quinsel, mentioning Augustine Daly's famous production, which had worn from a great public success down to an amateur theatrical favorite, with many of the troublesome accessories cut out and the personae reduced to the smallest possible number. Drouet had seen this play some time in the past.
"That's it," he said. "That's a fine play. It will go all right. You ought to make a lot of money out of that."
"We think we'll do very well," Mr. Quinsel replied. "Don't you forget now," he concluded, Drouet showing signs of restlessness, "some young woman to take the part of Laura."
"Sure, I'll attend to it." He moved away, forgetting almost all about it the moment Mr. Quinsel had ceased talking. He had not even thought to ask the time or place. Drouet was reminded of his promise a day or two later by the receipt of a letter announcing that the first rehearsal was set for the following Friday evening, and urging him to kindly forward the young lady's address at once, in order that the part might be delivered to her.
"Now, who the deuce do I know?" asked the drummer reflectively, scratching his rosy ear. "I don't know anyone that knows anything about amateur theatricals."
He went over in memory the names of a number of women he knew, and finally fixed on one, largely because of the convenient location of her home on the west side, and promised himself that as he came out that evening he would see her. When, however, he started west on the car, he forgot, and was only reminded of his delinquency by an item in the Evening News, a small three-line affair under the head of Secret Society Notes, which stated the Custer Lodge of the Order of Elks would give a theatrical performance in Avery Hall on the 16th, when Under the Gaslight would be produced.
"George!" exclaimed Drouet. "I forgot that!"
"What?" inquired Carrie. They were at their little table in the room which might have been used for a kitchen, where Carrie occasionally served a meal. Tonight the fancy had caught her, and the little table was spread with a pleasing repast.
"Why my lodge entertainment? They're going to give a play, and they wanted me to get some young lady to take a part."
"What is it they're going to play?"
"Under the Gaslight."
"When?"
"On the 16th.
"Well, why don't you?" asked Carrie.
"I don't know anyone," he replied.
Suddenly he looked up.
Say, he said, how would you like to take the part?
Me, said Carrie. I can't act.
How do you know? Questioned Drouet reflectively.
Because, answered Carrie, I never did. Nevertheless, she was pleased to think he would ask. Her eyes brightened, for if there was anything that enlisted her sympathies, it was the art of the stage.
True to his nature, Drouet clung to this idea as an easy way out.
That's nothing. You can act all you have to down there.
No, I can't, said Carrie weakly, very much drawn toward the proposition and yet fearful.
Yes, you can. Now, why don't you do it? They need someone, and it'll be lots of fun for you.
Oh, no, it won't, said Carrie seriously.
You'd like that. I know you would. I've seen you dancing around here and giving imitations, and that's why I asked you. You're clever enough, all right.
No, I'm not, said Carrie shyly.
Now, I'll tell you what you do. You go down and see about it. It'll be fun for you. The rest of the company isn't going to be any good. They haven't any experience. What do they know about theatricals?
He frowned as he thought of their ignorance.
Hand me the coffee, he added. I don't believe I could act, Charlie, Carrie went on pettishly. You don't think I could, do you?
Sure, out of sight. I bet you make a hit.
Now, you want to go, I know you do. I knew it when I came home. That's why I asked you.
What is the play, did you say?
Under the Gaslight.
What part would they want me to take?
Oh, one of the heroines, I don't know.
What sort of a play is it?
Well, said Drouet, whose memory for such things was not the best, it's about a girl who gets kidnapped by a couple of crooks, a man and a woman that live in the slums. She had some money or something, and they wanted to get it.
I don't know now how it did go exactly.
Don't you know what part I would have to take?
No, I don't, to tell the truth. He thought a moment.
Yes, I do, too. Laura, that's the thing. You're to be Laura.
And you can't remember what the part is like?
To save me, Cat, I can't, he answered. I ought to, too. I've seen the play enough. There's a girl in it that was stolen when she was an infant, was picked off the street or something, and she's the one that's hounded by the two old criminals I was telling you about.
He stopped with a mouthful of pie poised on a fork before his face.
She comes very near getting drowned. No, that's not it. I'll tell you what I'll do, he concluded hopelessly. I'll get you the book. I can't remember now for the life of me.
Well, I don't know, said Carrie, when he had concluded, her interest and desire to shine dramatically struggling with her timidity for the mastery. I might go if you thought I'd do all right.
Of course you'll do, said Drouet, who, in his efforts to enthuse Carrie, had interested himself. Do you think I'd come home here and urge you to do something that I didn't think you would make a success of? You can act all right. It'll be good for you.
When must I go? Said Carrie reflectively.
The first rehearsal is Friday night. I'll get the part for you tonight.
All right, said Carrie resignedly. I'll do it. But if I make a failure now, it's your fault.
You won't fail, assured Drouet. Just act as you do around here. Be natural. You're all right. I've often thought you'd make a corking good actress.
Did you really? Asked Carrie.
That's right, said the drummer.
He little knew as he went out of the door that night what a secret flame he had kindled in the bosom of the girl he left behind. Carrie was